So tonight's talk will be about how we can live from our deepest, wisest truth during times of conflict. And whether we're thinking of it as conflict in the world or conflict in our own relationships or conflict internally, how do we live from what's called Buddha nature, from the awakened heart during conflictual times? And the given is when there's conflict, that's when we're most in trance. That's when we're most reactive. And I wanted to talk about this because I've been reflecting a lot about, you know, well, what would be a way for us to deepen or wake up around what's going on in our country right now, the day after elections? Because it stirs up so much, right? So let me begin by asking, how many of you felt emotionally tugged around? And be honest, we're all friends here. How many felt really kind of caught in it, like in the grip of it, really, yeah, tugged around? I'm raising my hand here. Okay, a lot of us, right? This is a personally a live one for me because I get amazed at myself how quickly I fall into, it's a seduction into this sense of us and them. How many of you notice that? Us against them. Yeah, it's a lot of us. So one of the things, I mean, I've been in conversation with different people, you know, in the Dharma and the meditation communities around the country. There's been a lot of calling and phone call, you know, these last 24 hours, and both a sense of, you know, there's a sense of hopefulness in many people, but also this kind of, this is the power of mindfulness, to really investigate what are our patterns and how are we caught. And one of the places of getting caught is how easy it is to fall into a sense of the kind of judgment or blame that has a lot of aversion and acrimony. How it is easy it is to have a person and decide you hate them or don't like them. And how easy it is to feel punitive or feel like, you know, how they found in sports that we identify with a team and our chemicals change if we win or lose. I mean, how many get an endorphin testosterone rush when we win and drop down when we lose? And how much are we addicted to that? And getting back at vengeance, you know. So I'm just naming some of the currents that, you know, when we're honest with ourselves, we can kind of see in our own psyches. And I think it's really humbling. It's very humbling to know that we're really committed and wanting a world with peace and justice and freedom, a world where there's more love, and then to watch in our own hearts how easy it is to get caught in the aversive us-them mentality. It's humbling. And if that didn't feel relevant for yesterday for you, then we all know it when we get into our personal lives, that when others in some way hurt us or don't cooperate with us, so quickly they become the other. There's a distance. And we get into that trance, and our hearts get armored. So one woman, Mae Sarton, described how the greatest grief in the world is this kind of shutting down and not offering the gift of our love to those that are close to us. Because in some way we're holding a resentment. They're other. They've become other. Do you know what I mean? How many moments we can live like that? So I'd like to explore the Buddhist teachings and practices that help us to wake up out of that trance of self in here and other out there, especially when the other out there is someone we have a story around that's causing suffering and the troublemaker or the problem. It's as Ramakrishna, one of the great teachers, put it, that the real spirit of the whole path is to not exclude anyone from our hearts. And that's not just some ideal. The reality is, if we want peace on earth, our hearts need to be able to include even those that we feel cause suffering. And that's not easy. One of the understandings in the Buddhist tradition and in most of the wisdom traditions, which has to do with karma, is that in any moment that we're having thoughts that are mean-spirited, like, well, they got theirs, or, you know, in some way wishing ill to others, just thoughts. And we're not talking about actions. We're not talking about going out and physically hurting others. It's even thoughts. In some way, we're fueling the cycles of violence. So tonight, this is really an exploration that I think of as very radical, which is how our every thought, our every action affects this world. That if we're living with some ideal of healing the world, the only way is to get very specific with this moment. Is this heart defended? Am I living in a trance of us and them? Or is there some investigation and opening? And it takes courage to really be with what's here. Probably the phrase that most people are familiar with in this theme is what Mahatma Gandhi said. He said, to be the change we seek. Now, let's just say, what does that mean to us? Okay, to be the change we seek. Because it's a good soundbite, but how often do we actually sense, all right, so what is the change I really want, and what does it mean for me to be that? So why don't we start, because as you know, in most of these classes, I'll have you pick something relevant to you in your life and work with it a little tonight. It's the only way it gets real, you know. So just take a moment, and we'll just reflect, each of us, in our own lives, where you might be in the trance of self and other, where there might be some conflict or difficulty. Just choosing. It might be with someone that's close into you, where you're wanting things different, where it's not, the relationship's not where you want it. Or it might be that you're feeling conflict or at odds with some public figure. But just take a moment to sense the conflict and the nature of it, how it feels in your heart, what it's like to be at odds, to have an other that you feel down on or blamed towards or disconnected from. You might sense a situation that causes or brings up the sense of distance. So this is an example for you in your life where there's some tensions, some feelings of hurt or anger, distrust. And sense, well, what is the change you want? Now, perhaps what you immediately go for is how you want them to change. That's our way. But what is it you're really wanting? How do you want your experience to be? How do you want to relate to this? How might the highest part of your being relate to this? The Buddha or Bodhisattva that's listening right now. That in you, which is most wise. How might that be relating? So this is the inquiry. You might not have a full-blown, oh, it would be like this. But this is the question. If there's a conflict, how do you want to hold it? You know the way that we hold it in trance, the reactivity, but how does the highest part of your being know to hold this? And we're going to come back to this, okay? So you can open your eyes. I want to share a story that I heard about recently. Somebody sent this to me about a therapist in Hawaii who cured a complete ward of criminally insane people. Okay? So he used a Hawaiian healing process called Ho'oponopono. His name's Dr. Hugh Len. And I'll read you a little. Dr. Len told, this was the person that was interviewing him, that he never saw the patients. Okay, he healed the whole ward of criminally insane patients, but he never saw them. Okay. He agreed to have an office and to review their files. While he looked at those files, he would work on himself. And as he worked on himself, the patients began to heal. Okay, so listen on. So the person that was interviewing him asked the million-dollar question, okay, so what were you doing within yourself that caused these people to change? Right? That's the question. So then his response, I was simply healing the part of me that created them. And then the person says, I didn't understand. So Dr. Len explained that total responsibility for your life means that everything in your life, simply because it is in your life, is your responsibility. In a literal sense, the entire world is your creation. Phew. This is tough to swallow. Being responsible for what I say or do is one thing. Being responsible for what everyone in my life says or does is quite another. Yet the truth is this. If you take complete responsibility for your life, then everything you see, hear, taste, touch, or in any way experience is your responsibility because it's in your life. This means that terrorist activity, the president, the economy, anything you experience and don't like is up for you to heal. They don't exist in a manner of speaking except as projections from inside you. The problem isn't with them, it's with you, and to change them, you have to change you. I know this is tough to grasp, let alone accept or actually live. Blame is far easier than total responsibility. But as I spoke with Dr. Len, I began to realize that healing for him, and in Ho'oponopono, means loving life. Healing means loving life. If you want to improve your life, you have to heal your life. If you want to cure anyone, even a mentally ill criminal, you do it by healing you. I asked Dr. Len how he went about healing himself. What was he doing exactly when he looked at those patients' files? Okay, he said, I just kept saying, I'm sorry and I love you over and over again. He explained, that's it. That's it. I'm sorry and I love you. Okay, so some commentary on this story. It doesn't matter so much, I don't think, what we believe about it. I don't even know if he exists or if there was a ward for criminally insane in Hawaii. I don't know anything about the background of this story. But there are two kind of major teaching points in there that I think are really relevant. The first one is difficult to understand, and you don't really have to understand it because you can do the second one's the more active process. The first one really is that in ultimate reality, there is no other out there any more than there's a solid entity of self in here. There's just experience happening. And whatever is experienced, we can be aware of in a way that's either healing or perpetuates reactivity. So this is what's meant by responsibility, that we are responsible. We're capable of responding to whatever arises in our field of experience. Everything that you experience is part of your awareness, it's part of you, and you can respond to it. That's part one, that there's nothing out there. Now, whether or not that resonates isn't as important as the actual meditation that Dr. Len in this story was doing, which is that, and this is something I think a lot of us can agree with, that healing begins, it always begins, by attending to our own hearts. It doesn't mean that we might not do other things. Like we can do other things to take care of ourselves, to protect ourselves. But real healing and transformation, by becoming present and having the courage to be with the intensity and the shadow and the pain in our own hearts. That's always the first place. And there's this understanding that this world's all interconnected. So if we bring attention to our own hearts and dissolve some of the armor, it's going to have an effect. Now, some people believe that, you know, long-distance prayer, you can have someone in your mind and heal them. Others don't. But we all probably intuitively sense that the more open-hearted and generous and loving we are, the more that somehow or other ripples out in a helpful way. That's the starting place. It's where our power is. We can always start with whatever's right here in this body, heart, and mind, and bring a quality of awakeness and care to that. So this is the meaning of karma, that whatever we do in the moment has an effect. And our power is in any moment to pay attention to the knots, the squeezing, the reactivity that's within us. So again, it doesn't mean that if we say we're responsible, that we become passive. We can be totally responsible and totally responding to the knots in our own being and still lock the door and still absolutely vote and still put some people in prison that are dangerous and still go on peace marches or whatever it is. We do things. But the work of the heart, if our heart is at war, we are perpetuating the violence in the world. There is a trance that is very basic to all creation. You know, the poet Rumi says that whatever comes into being gets lost in being, forgetting our way home. We forget our home. And we get caught in some idea of self and other and something to protect and something to defend against. We get identified in that way. And when the other causes, when we feel unpleasantness, we are biologically rigged to push away. And we all do it. So every one of us is working with judgment, with aversion, with armoring around our heart. Every one of us has that cooking. Okay, that's kind of the given. We can sense it. One of the most basic ways we are at war is we make other people wrong. Most of you have heard the phrase, the world is divided into those who think they're right. And that's the whole phrase, you know. But isn't it true that we think we're right? And that we think others are wrong, and that we really believe we're right, and we know that we're believing that, but we still think it's true, you know. And then what happens is, when they're wrong, they're bad in some way. When they don't agree with us, there's a little girl is talking to her teacher about whales, and the teacher said it was physically impossible for a whale to swallow a human because even though it was a very large mammal, its throat was very small. The little girl stated that Jonah was swallowed by a whale. Irritated, the teacher reiterated that a whale couldn't swallow a human. It was physically impossible. The little girl said, "Well, when I get to heaven, I will ask Jonah." The teacher asked, "Well, what if Jonah went to hell?" The little girl replied, "Then you ask him." So, but again, isn't it true that, you know, if somebody doesn't agree with us, it's like, well, go to hell, you know? It's like, in some... So what we're talking about is the war that, you know, that we really... I would say everyone here, on some level, really has a yearning for more peace on this earth. And the pathway is to recognize... How are the ways that in our own lives, with the people closest to us, and in the way we relate to the politics of the day, we are subscribing to that trance of bad other, wrong other, evil other? If this was at one of the day-long workshops I do, I would actually have us break into small groups and do a little, just speak real honestly, kind of a confession, like, yeah, I get caught in making this person bad. When I see this person's face in the newspaper, everything in me gets yucked out, you know? It's like I feel evil, you know? I'm talking about it because I'm finding it such a challenge in my own life to read the newspaper and not get caught in that trance, to listen to the news, to watch last night's returns, you know, and not in some way have that affiliation and small-mindedness and triumphalism or whatever it is that is smaller than feeling, you know how T.S. Eliot put it? He said, the wisdom is to care and not to care. And what that means is that we move through a day like yesterday and we care because we really care about the earth and we love life and we really want for the best for this world. So in our own ways, that translates to what we think should happen, but we care. But the not to care part is that there's not the grasping or attachment that makes it personal. There's not the aversion or the making war. We care, but it's with this open-handedness, this open heart. We're not caught in self and other. So the more that we've been wounded, the more we're afraid, the more we lock into the trance. And sometimes it becomes our whole filter. So whoever we meet, there's a kind of inclination to distrust or be defended or whatever. Some of you might remember this story from Australia. Post office, a postal worker saw a postcard addressed to God. Do you remember this? This woman said she was elderly and very much in the need of $100. Could God help her out? So the woman who saw this from the post office was moved and made a collection from those that were there, and they sent the woman $90. Okay. And some days later, another postcard addressed to God arrives. Same woman. She had written, "Dear God, thank you very much for sending the money, but I only received $90. It must have been those bastards at the post office." Right? So, but you get the idea. This kind of inclination to think other and others against me in some way. Are others going to reject me? Are others not going to accept me? Are others going to kill me? You know, and the truth is, we do get lied to, and we do get wounded, and we do get manipulated. So there are people that cause suffering. And then there's a chain of reactivity where we then cause suffering back. So I want to just read you a little bit from Thomas More. He says, "It is often said accurately that violence begets violence. There is a virus buried deep in all violence that is contagious, that inspires an equally brutal and mindless response." There's a virus buried deep in all violence that is contagious, that inspires an equally brutal and mindless response. So this is how we're rigged. Something, we experience something and we are programmed to violate back. We're programmed that way. It happens amongst people in our personal relationships. In the post a few days ago, there was some research on monkeys and how when monkeys that were babies were abused by older monkeys, they ended up abusing their babies. There's a virus embedded in violence that invites back the same. And does it help to aggress? Does it help to violate back? I mean, we know the cycles. Again, I'll read you from Thomas More. He says, "There's good news. The gospel of Jesus, the Dharma of the Buddha, the Tao of Lao Tzu, the Taraka, our way of love and Sufism, and many other traditions, all teach that you can let go of your grip on this chain. You can be free from it. When obscene violence interrupts your life, you don't have to respond with virtuous, justified, and reasonable force. You can choose not to be part of the destructive cycle. And that choice not to participate is a first step towards peace. Now, we're not just talking about, okay, if a nation does something violent that we have to go in and attack them. We're talking about in the everyday way in our life, when somebody does something a little bit rude or ignores us in some way or is offensive and critical, whatever it is, somebody we're married to or a child or a friend, that we can break the chain of our conditioning by not responding in like, but rather, and this is what the Hawaiian shaman did, this is really what's possible, rather than reacting, we can find the place in our own hearts that has some sort of a shadow or a twist or a tightness and do the healing right here. That's the possibility. And it's described this simply. We have the capacity to be 100% responsible. We really do. And there's incredible empowerment when you start exploring that. In fact, it's disempowering to come from any other worldview. To sense that in any moment, it's our nature, it's our Buddha nature, to be able to meet whatever arises and have it wake up our hearts. That's our capacity. To assume that ends up waking us up. So Nelson Mandela's story, 12 years in solitary confinement, and he became really depressed. And he inquired, because he had this belief that it might never be possible again to have love in his life. Okay. And so he didn't know how long he'd be in. And so he basically couldn't live with that. It's like here he was being tortured. It had already been 12 years. And so he was living with the prospect of never having love in his life. So he decided that he was going to love his guards. And they kept having to rotate his guards because his guards couldn't torture him. Isn't that amazing? This is a true story. I don't know about the Hawaiian shaman. I like the teaching in it, but I don't know about the story. But this is true. He took 100% responsibility. And this is like, we're talking about somebody being tortured, not somebody being criticized or, you know, the stuff a lot of us, you know, although many of us have been abused and have had horrific stuff. What I'm saying is that it doesn't matter how bad it is. We have the capacity to wake up our hearts and to really affect healing. So let's look a little closer on how, and then I'd like to do a meditation with you just to explore how you might feel more freedom in a conflictual area to not be in the chain of reaction. How it works, in the moment that we're stuck, when there's anger or aversion, what's happening is, in some way, there's a deep need in us that's not being met. That's the first thing, is that if we pause and check in, anytime we're in reaction, there's some need that is not being met. That's part one. And then what's happening is, and this is what we're rigged to do, we're fixating on the other is wrong, the other is bad. What can we do to push away the other? And the challenge is that if we don't break the chain of reaction and we push away the other, we still won't get our needs met. That's where most of us are living. When we talk about repeating patterns in our life, people do stuff to us, we do stuff back to them, it just goes back and forth. So how to respond differently? How do we stop the war? The first is to pause. It's always the first step. When you recognize that you've created self and other, that somebody's become your enemy, your adversary, your opponent, to pause. Create a space. Like, give yourself that gift of this is the space to see if it's possible to take responsibility and do healing. That is radical, that is brave, and that's the hope for the world. Pause and ask, okay, what's going on inside me right now? Then what we'll find is that we're angry, we're hurt, and if we really look deeply, there's a need that's not being met. Maybe you don't feel safe. Maybe you don't feel understood. Maybe you don't feel accepted, but there's some need that's there that's really not being met. That's when we then do what the Hawaiian shaman said. Once you felt the need, you can then begin the practice of, I'm sorry, I love you. I'm sorry, I love you. In Buddhism, this is called the metta, loving kindness, and karuna, compassion practice. The compassion practice is, I'm sorry, I care. And metta, I love you. They have different flavors. If you start by saying you're sorry, that's like you're recognizing, okay, there's hurt here, there's vulnerability. That begins to tenderize the heart. Then if you say, I love you, you're offering a kind presence. You're saying, I'm staying, I'm here. The most beautiful and direct expression of love is presence, is attention. So this is, if we want to break the chain of reactivity, pause. What's the unmet need inside me? I'm sorry. I love you. We're going to practice in a minute. But I just want to say that once we've done that with ourselves, we can look and see others. And what do we see about them? The unmet needs in them. We can feel our, I'm sorry for your suffering, and I love you. We can move in that direction. So as one of my friends, a yoga teacher, described it, we begin. The step one is turning inward. He says, you know, the yoga teacher said, take your arms and hug yourself. And then he said, then switch and put the other arm on top and hug your evil twin. You know? I really like that. So we do that with ourselves. And we begin to hold what's painful. And then we can look at another. And I'll read you Gary Larson's version of how we can look at the other. Two women behind locked doors peeping through the window at a monster on the doorstep. Well, yes, Edna. This is the one woman saying to the other. Well, yes, Edna. It is a giant, hideous insect. But maybe it's a giant, hideous insect in need of help. You get the idea. So this is the breaking the chain of reactivity, whether it's the small distances that keep us kind of separate from people that we love close in, whether it's with somebody that's abused us in a big way and we're just hardened in hatred, or whether it's a political figure that we've locked into feeling a disdain for. It's the same process. And what is so important to remember is, even if it's just thoughts that are not benevolent towards that political figure out there, we're part of fueling the trance if we don't pause and come back to ourselves and our own hearts. We can't get away with anything. The more mindful you are, the harder it is to live with, you know, it's seductive, but it's harder to live in that us-them reality. Read you George Washington Carver. How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, tolerant of the weak and the strong, because someday in this life you will have been all of these. In Buddhism and in all the wisdom traditions, where this leads, this breaking of the chain of reactivity, is waking up to a sense of we're in it together, we belong. Some of you have heard of Oriya, Mountain Dreamer, who's a poet and a spiritual teacher. And she described an experience she had after doing a day-long, she had led a day-long meditation workshop. And at the end of the workshop, she was tired and ready to leave, had to get home to her kids. But a woman named Isabel, she's a small, thin woman in an oversized park, introduced herself and wanted to ask her some questions. She said, "Can I do this meditation on my own?" "Well, yes," I said, "I'm sure you can, although many people find it easier to establish a meditation practice with the help of a group. It's just hard to keep up the discipline on your own." "But what will it give me? What will I get if I do this every day?" Her tone took on a whining quality, and I felt my irritation rise as she continued. "How fast will it work? Will I feel a difference after a week? How will I know it's working?" This is exactly the kind of thing I detested, this quest for the quick fix, the desire for guaranteed outcomes, the simple answer. Do this, you'll get that. My sons are waiting for me and I wanted to go home. I took a deep breath and looked directly at Isabel and set my knapsack down on the floor. I tried to slow down my words, thinking that maybe if I spoke slower, I would feel more patient. "Well," I said, "meditation is more a process than a goal-oriented activity. It can help you become more aware of what's going on within and around you, and this can help reduce stress. My best advice is just to try it and be patient with yourself." I picked up my bag and started to button my coat. I really did have to leave, and I wanted to get out while I was feeling virtuous for not snapping her head off. But as I started to move away, Isabel suddenly reached out and grabbed my arm with surprising strength. "But what I want to know," she said, her voice rising in a crescendo that bordered on real panic, "is will it help me find God? If I meditate, will I have an experience of something or someone out there listening, something really with me?" A wave of desperation swept out from her through me, and I was surprised to find my eyes filling with tears. This woman wasn't looking for an easy answer or a guaranteed formula because she was lazy. She didn't want a simple plan because she was unable or unwilling to think critically about what would work. She wanted something she knew would work and work quickly because she was hanging on by her fingernails. She wanted something that would work in a week because she was afraid that she simply wasn't going to make it through months or years. I put my hand gently over Isabel's where it gripped my arm. "It's okay, Isabel. We all feel desperate at times," I said. "Nobody does it by themselves. We all need help." Her hand relaxed a little beneath mine and she started to cry. We talked for a while longer. "There is no them. There's only us. When I left, I did not leave one of them. I said goodbye to one of us, a human being doing the best she can, searching for the home for which all our hearts long." It doesn't matter how bad someone looks in the sense of how evil it seems their actions are. Deep down, as the Dalai Lama puts it, no one wants to suffer. Everyone wants to feel happy. We all want to come home into our hearts and our lives. And yet there's a lot of wounding. So when we see somebody acting in a way that causes violence, they've been violated. If they cause suffering, they've suffered. And the deepest suffering, the feeling of unlove. No one causes suffering if they're happy and feel loved. It just doesn't happen. So our challenge, just to name it, is that as we deepen on this path, and it's a real commitment, it's to have more and more moments expressed from our wisdom and our awakened heart, not to be in that trance of self-other. Our challenge is to notice when our thoughts buy in, when we're sensing ourselves being demeaning towards others in our minds, our actions, blaming, and how to come back and, like this Hawaiian shaman, this practice of loving, really be with the place in our own heart that's reacting. "I'm sorry. I love you." Try it. It's an interesting practice to take responsibility on that level. Let's try it out together just for a few minutes and then we'll close. So there have been a lot of words. Let there be a few moments just to pause, to feel your breath. Just notice how it is for you right now, right here. And just to feel your intention to be part of living love in this planet, to being the change that you seek. And just sensing that intention, then letting yourself go to or choose a situation where you'd like to be meeting it with more awakeness, where you don't want to be caught in the chain of reaction. So it could be something with somebody close to you or in your circle of family, friends, colleagues, where there's an angry reaction, an irritated reaction, and distance. Or it might be a public figure. Since the elections are so close for many people, you know for yourself where you find yourself kind of locked into aversion. You can explore that a little tonight. And again, this isn't about inactivity. This is about really healing your own heart. To sense a situation, sense what it is that really triggers you. What's going on? It might be the way someone looks or speaks or acts or treats you. So we pause, just to sense that and pause and feel, okay, let me be with this right now. 100% responsibility to let go of the story some and just sense what's happening inside you. What does this bring up? What's the feeling? Maybe it's straightforward anger, irritation, hurt, fear. You might sense what's the unmet need. Is it that this person contributes to having you feel unsafe, disempowered, not loved, not supported, not understood? It might be that it's hard to find that and that you leave here tonight with just a recognition that this is part of being mindful, is to sense what the unmet need is in you. And if you feel it, if you can feel, oh, okay, so I just don't feel seen or I don't feel respected, cared about, then to begin, I'm sorry, I love you. And if it helps you to put your hand on your heart, just to feel that you're really offering yourself this presence. It can be a very powerful thing if you haven't done this before. You're establishing a new relationship with your inner life. You're breaking the chain of reactivity, of acting out, and instead bringing presence to this inner life. I'm sorry. I care about this suffering. I love you. Sense that you're the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, the Christ, Divine Mother, just offering presence to whatever your heart is experiencing. Look through the eyes of wisdom. with the heart of wisdom at your inner life right now. And it might be that you just mentally whisper the words, "I'm sorry, I love you," and just see what happens. Not trying to change anything, just being present with what's here. So that whatever you're experiencing in this meditation right now, there's no wrong way to do it. There's simply noticing what's happening and allowing it with a gentle heart. That's the essence of loving presence. Holding your own heart with care and then looking through the eyes of the bodhisattva of wisdom at the other, the one you consider other. Can you sense the unmet needs of that being? Can you regard with compassion? If not, that's fine. Just continue to pay attention to where there's still hurt and reaction in your own heart. To break the chain of reactivity, we just take responsibility and pay attention to the hurt that's here. That's the beginning. There's enormous freedom as we learn to pause and come home to the experience that's here. That we begin to discover the truth of what we are, that awareness and that love that's bigger than any self, any conflicted self. There's a very awake, loving presence that's listening right now through your ears, that sees through your eyes this very moment when you drop all ideas of self or other. Closing with the words of Rumi, beyond wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, there's only peace. Even the idea, each other, doesn't make any sense. Beyond wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. So we close with a metta, a loving kindness prayer for the world in these difficult times, that all beings may be held in loving kindness and filled with loving kindness. That all beings might know their belonging, their connectedness with this life. That there be peace on earth, peace everywhere. That all beings everywhere awaken and be free. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.